Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on quacks and quackery when we come back. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party, limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, it is regulated by the Welfare Department, the Department of Family Services, and the Family Court. And the best part about it all is that you have no input into or say-so over the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of it. And if you fail to pay, you go to jail. Now, marriage is the most important and expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding and more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage. And you probably know a whole lot less about it than you do your military obligation or your house payments. Now, two-thirds of all marriages here in the United States end in divorce. But whether you're a husband or a wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect or defend against any breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you should know and understand the terms and conditions of that marriage contract before you marry. And you should write that contract instead of letting the state write it for you. So whether you're married or not, why don't you write for our free general law CD package and let me share some vital information with you about the law and that marriage contract. Just call us direct. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. And remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. And you can order it direct by calling, or you can go onto our webpage, georgegordon.org, or georgegordon.com. Just go to the archives page and download it. It's there available to you. You can stream it, or you can download it onto a CD and play it later. All right, we're talking about this thing of quacks and quackery. And last time, we were looking at the focus of the AMA. And the focus of the AMA is to protect physicians' incomes against government intrusion in the practice of medicine. And this was the case back in the 1930s, the case of having their cake and eating it too. And while steadfastly opposing any government supervision of this medical monopoly, the monopolists frequently forced various government agencies to act against anyone who posed a threat to their monopoly, having them arrested, prosecuted, and sent to prison. Now, this is why I said last time, this thing is genius. I mean, absolute genius. The mafia, Al Capone, all of the organized crime in America, these guys are pikers compared to the pharmaceutical industries and the American Medical Association. These guys are smart enough to go right into the halls of Congress and have the laws written that they want. And anybody that offers any competition, chiropractors, naturopaths, quacks, they're out here practicing medicine without a license, why, you have them arrested, like Bruce Halstead or Renee Cassett. You have these people prosecuted. You have them jailed. Put them out of business. We'll teach them to go out here and compete with us guys. And that's what you doctors belong to. You belong to an organized crime syndicate. And it's genius in its operation. It's genius in its creation. It's just absolutely the perfect crime. I mean, how can you do better than have the criminals control the lawmaking process? Can you imagine Murder Incorporated having laws enacted for their business? And that's just the way life is. Doc Simmons' lucrative dominance of the American Medical Association led him into numerous sidelines. In 1921, Simmons established the Institute of Medicine in Chicago. This apparently was nothing more than a holding company for his bribes. He had also been enjoying the prerequisites of the American success story. A buxom mistress installed in a luxurious Gold Coast apartment. Scoundrel that he was, Simmons was not content to flaunt his liaison to his wife. He also became increasingly cruel in his determination to get rid of her. He then embarked on a classic ploy, the physician attempting to dispose of an unwanted wife by plying her with narcotics, trying to convince her that she was going insane, and hopefully driving her to suicide. After some months of this treatment, his wife fought back by filing suit against him. It produced a highly publicized trial in 1924. It ended in his wife's testimony that he had given her heavy doses of narcotics prescribed on the strength of his medical experience, and then began proceedings to have her declared insane. This was not such an unusual procedure during that period. It had happened to literally hundreds of wives. However, this wife proved to be tougher than most victims. and she testified in court that he had tried to have her framed on a charge of insanity. This trial inspired more than a dozen subsequent books, plays, and movies based upon the story of a physician who tries to drive his wife insane through a campaign of ministration of drugs and psychological terrorism. The most famous was called Gaslight, in which Charles Boyer played the role of Doc Simmons to perfection, the luckless wife being played by Ingrid Bergman. The trial brought Simmons a torrent of unpleasant publicity, and it forced his retirement as head of the AMA. However, he retained the title of General Editor Emeritus, absenting himself in 1924 until his death in 1937. Morris Fishbein, still operating under his lucky star, was now moved into total dominance of the AMA. Between the two of them, they controlled the AMA for more than half a century, perfecting their techniques for using this organization to raise money, exercise political clout, and to maintain dominance over physicians, hospitals, drug companies, and concerned government agencies. Simmons moved to Hollywood, Florida, where he lived until 1937. His New York Times obituary was headlined, "Noted for War on Quacks." So Simmons' presidency of the American Medical Association was noted for their war on quacks. I can underline that. Simmons' longtime critic, Dr. Emanuel Josephson, noted that this was an odd memorial for a man who had long been known as the Prince of Quacks. All right, I'm going to underline the Prince of Quacks. Morris Fishbein also inherited Simmons' able assistant at the AMA, Dr. Olin West. West was born in 1874 and died in 1952. West had been state director in Tennessee for the Rockefeller Sanitary Commission from 1910 to 1918. Thus, he had the requisite credentials as a representative of the Rockefeller connection at the American Medical Association headquarters. Dr. Josephson later termed Fishbein the Hitler of the medical profession. He called West as his Goring. Fishbein remained aware of the AMA's ability to use the government's employees for AMA purposes. Of the first 15 members of the Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry, three had been members of the federal government. With the disappearance of Simmons, Fishbein now had a free hand. From that day on, he made sure that when anyone mentioned the AMA, they also paid tribute to Morris Fishbein. He used his position there to launch a host of private enterprises, including book publishing, lecturing, and writing feature newspaper columns. On a very modest salary of $24,000 a year from the AMA, Fishbein became the playboy of the Western world. His children were supervised by a French governess, while he commuted weekly to New York to be seen at the Stork Club and to attend first nights at the theater. Fees, kickbacks, awards, and other monies poured into his coffers in a veritable flood. And during his 25 years of power at the American Medical Association, he never lost an opportunity to advertise and to enrich himself. Despite the fact that he had never practiced medicine a single day of his life, he persuaded King Features Syndicate to sign him on as daily columnist writing a medical commentary, which appeared in over 200 newspapers. A full-page ad appeared in Editor and Publisher to celebrate his new venture on March 23, 1940, stating, "An authority of medicine, Dr. Fishbein's name is synonymous with the sterling stamp on a piece of silver." Whether this was an oblique reference to Judas is not clear. Fishbein garnered additional income by having himself named medical advisor to Look magazine, the second largest publication in the United States. In 1935, Fishbein had ventured into what was probably his greatest financial coup, the annual publication of a massive volume called The Modern Home Medical Advisor. The book was written for him by doctors on consignment, but he wrote the lurid advertising copy, endorsed by doctors everywhere. The wealthiest millionaire could not buy better health guidance. Obviously, no doctor anywhere dared to criticize the book. Fishbein's steadily aggrandizing powers at the AMA were veiled by the fact that he never had any title there except editor. He maintained absolute control over all of the publications of the AMA and thus gained his total power over the organization. No one who disagreed with him had any opportunity to voice any discontent. He also maintained absolute control over the selection of the personnel of the various committees of the AMA so that no one was ever in a position to attack him. The Committee on Food and the Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry were his particular preserves because of the great power they had over manufacturers and advertisers. The Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry had been set up in 1905 at the same time that the Food and Drug Act had been passed by Congress. The two groups always worked together very closely. As advertising revenues increased every year, Fishbein steadfastly denied that any profits were being made by the American Medical Association, and he was quoted in Review of Reviews in 1926. Quote, far from being the corporation not-for-profit which the statutes listed, the American Medical Association has been exceedingly profitable to the public, both in dollars and in lives, unquote. Thus, Fishbein very adeptly turned aside growing criticism of the income of the AMA by his claim that it was profitable to the public at large. Under Fishbein's editorship, the AMA health magazine, Hygieia, carried the banner headline, Pure Foods Honestly Advertised. The seal of acceptance of the Committee on Foods of the AMA is your best guarantee that the claims of quality for any product are correct and that the advertising for it is truthful. Look for this seal on every food that you buy. White Star Tuna and Chicken of the Sea brand tuna have this acceptance. At the very time that Fishbein was running these advertisements, the Food and Drug Administration was repeatedly seizing shipments of these very brands of tuna, condemning them because they consisted in whole or in part of decomposed animal substance. So much for the seal of acceptance. Hey, while we're talking about the seal of acceptance, have you ever heard the word kosher? Well, my father-in-law years ago used to work for the railroad up in Chicago. And he told us that the way kosher worked during the 1930s and 1940s into the 50s worked like this. A committee of rabbis would come down to the railroad yards, and they in turn would shoot a fire hose onto the side of the boxcar, which ostensibly contained the meat or whatever products were being koshered or cashered. Now, the real trick to this kosher, getting that little circle with the K inside, is paying a rabbinical association in New York City, just like paying the American Medical Association for their seal of approval. And back in the 1920s, a chicken company back in New York City sued the Council of Rabbis. I think that's what they called it, the Council of Rabbis in New York City, something on that order. They were a chicken processing company, and they came to the rabbis, and they said, now listen, we'd like you to tell us what it is that we have to do to get your kosher seal. And they said, you pay us green. This is green seal. And they refused, and so the controversy ultimately ended up in the Supreme Court. And here's what the Supreme Court had to say about it. If the church, that is the Jewish church, headed by the rabbis, requires that you pay them for their seal of approval, that's their private business. Doesn't have anything to do with commerce. So if you want that kosher seal to this day, you pay for it. That's all. And the same thing is true with the AMA. If you want their seal of approval, you pay for it. Just that simple. So I just thought, just as an aside, I'd pass that one on to you. It came from my father-in-law. The AMA Committee on Foods always verged on the brink of exposure or serious damage suits because it had virtually no testing apparatus. The June 24, 1931 issue of Business Week magazine raised serious questions about these operations, particularly the power of the AMA to censor manufacturers' ad copy. Business Week asked whether a national body of professional men conducted presumably on the highest ethical plane is not continually exceeding the natural boundaries of its actions when it attempts to assume police and regulatory powers over the nation's largest industry, the food processing industry. The editors of Business Week were well aware that the staff at the AMA did little testing and were not qualified to render judgments on the acceptance of products. The magazine story may have been intended as a quiet warning to the AMA to cease and desist its activities in this field. They reckoned without Fishbein's chutzpah. The AMA Committee on Foods, under Fishbein's guidance, continued its operations for another decade. In 1939, Fishbein awarded the seal of acceptance to some 2,706 individual products, which were produced by some 1,653 companies. Its chief rival in this field, the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval, had also come under increasing fire for its aggressive tactics in seeking more customers for its seal. In May of 1941, the Federal Trade Commission issued a cease and desist order against the Good Housekeeping Seal, and Fishbein saw the handwriting on the wall, and shortly afterwards he discontinued the AMA Seal of Acceptance Awards for General Purpose Foods. The Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry was quite another matter. This was the key to the big money, the pharmaceuticals. A drug company could make $100 million on a new product if it were to be released under the proper auspices. Now, the most vital, of course, was the AMA seal of acceptance. So the opportunities for large-scale bribery, conspiracy, and corruption were all too prevalent to be ignored. One physician who was very conscious of this was Dr. Emanuel Josephson of New York City, heir to a large fortune, Dr. Josephson resided in a multi-million dollar townhouse in the city's most expensive area, just around the corner from Nelson Rockefeller, on the fashionable Upper East Side. Josephson was unable to conceal his contempt for Fishbein and his money-grubbing activities. On January the 2nd, 1932, he officially resigned from the AMA's New York City Medical Society. The AMA chose to ignore his letter of resignation until 1938, when Fishbein released a letter claiming that the AMA had severed connections with Dr. Josephson. In 1939, Dr. Josephson submitted the important record of his groundbreaking research to Science magazine. It was vitamin E therapy of miasthenia gravis, which they refused to print. Dr. Josephson later pointed out that the AMA had deliberately concealed the benefits of vitamin E therapy for more than 25 years. And this was only one instance of hundreds in which the AMA withheld life-saving information from the public. The benefits of vitamin E therapy are now generally recognized by the medical profession. The American Medical Association technique for controlling all new products was revealed by a United Press dispatch dated January 20, 1940, that the AMA had a well-defined newspaper policy never to call anything a cure or, in fact, give publicity to any remedy of any description without a thorough investigation. The organization usually recommended that any report of a remedy should be referred to the New York branch of the American Medical Association for investigation. As Dr. Josephson testified, he had tried for years to get the New York chapter of the AMA to investigate his findings, but they always refused. The AMA Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry had effectively solidified its control by amending the official AMA Code of Ethics to prohibit individual physicians from giving any testimonials in favor of any drug. This amendment protected the valuable monopoly of the AMA headquarters in Chicago. A distinguished scientist and teacher, Dr. Frank G. Lidston, published a booklet, Why the AMA is Going Backward, in which he stated, quote, "The achievement of what the oligarchy of the AMA has boasted most vociferously has been its belated war on proprietaries, quack medical manufacturers, and unproven products. When I recall the nauseous array of proprietary fakes on the advertisements on which the oligarchy build its financial prosperity, its holier-than-thou pose is sickening. It was fitting to its psychic constitution that after the AMA has for years done its level best to promulgate the interests and to fatten upon fake manufacturers and professional poisoners of the innocent, it should bite the hand that fed it. Despotic power such as the oligarchy wields over the food and drug manufacturers is dangerous, and human nature being what it is, that power might be expected to sooner or later be abused." Now, Dr. Josephson also observed that the history of the AMA seal of acceptance is replete with betrayals of professional and public trust. Drug products of the highest value have been rejected or their acceptance unwarrantedly delayed. Worthless, dangerous, or deadly food and drugs have been hastily accepted. On April the 20th, 1936, Time magazine reported that the American Medical Association was then worth $3,800,000, of which $2 million was in government bonds, $1 million in cash, with an $800,000 headquarters building in Chicago. Time magazine also mentioned another little-known aspect of the AMA medical monopoly. Shoes designed to correct foot trouble must be approved by the AMA before a conscientious physician may prescribe them. Just how the AMA had set up this shoe monopoly was not clear. On July 7, 1961, Time reported that the AMA Journal now had a circulation of 180,000 with income of $16 million a year, the bulk from ads in its publications mainly by drug and appliance makers. The AMA Constitution states that it was organized to promote the art and science of medicine and the betterment of public health. Yet the history of the AMA was replete with events which contradicted this goal. Literary Digest reported on June 11, 1927, that the AMA had adopted a resolution that alcohol had no scientific place in medicine. In all fairness, it should be reported that the 1917 resolution had probably been passed at the behest of the Rockefeller interests, which for their own hidden purposes were strongly supporting passage of prohibition at that time. On February the 9th, 1977, the Federal Trade Commission issued an order against the AMA because it had barred certain drug advertisements. Throughout the 25-year reign of Morris Fishbein at the AMA, the organization repeatedly made bewildering about-face recommendations on certain products, the reason for such reversals being known only to Fishbein himself. The situation also offered impressive profits to be made by investing in the stock of a certain drug firm just before it received the coveted AMA seal of acceptance for a new product. After such an announcement, it was not unusual for the stock of that drug firm to double in price, and only Dr. Fishbein knew when such an approval would be released. Fishbein was a consummate inside trader. Now, one of the more reprehensible decisions made by Dr. Fishbein during his long reign at the AMA was his move to hush up a dangerous outbreak of amoebic dysentery in Chicago at the height of the World's Fair observance in 1933. Although the cause of the outbreak was traced to faulty plumbing at the Congress Hotel, Fishbein met with a group of Chicago business leaders and pledged the cooperation of the AMA in holding back any warnings until the fair had ended its season. Hundreds of unsuspecting tourists who visited the World's Fair returned to their hometowns infected with this terrible illness, which often lingers for years and is very difficult to treat or to cure. The list of dangerous drugs approved by Fishbein during his tenure as public spokesman for the AMA is lengthy and terrifying. Fishbein hastened to approve the notorious diet drug dinitrophenol, despite laboratory records that it was dangerous to health. Another drug, triparsamide, manufactured by Merck under license from the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, was a dangerous arsenical drug used to counter the effects of syphilis. It was abandoned by its discoverer, Paul Ehrlich, when he found that it caused blindness by atrophying the optic nerve. Ehrlich's warnings did not prevent the AMA, Merck, or the Rockefeller Institute from continuing to distribute this drug. In the March issue of June 21, 1937, Morris Fishbein had a cover portrait on Time magazine. It was an unusually unflattering photograph in which Fishbein looked as though he needed a doctor. Time had published a story earlier that year that Fishbein was suffering from Bell's palsy. The right side of his face hung slack, and he was obviously in very poor condition. We'll come back to Fishbein here right after this break. You know, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, now it's 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the law our website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile or political. They could be religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing the book, Murder by Injection, by Eustace Mullins. Actually, I'm reviewing specific chapters. This chapter on quacks and quackery. The AMA in 1868 came up with a definition that they followed this day on quacks and quackery. And the AMA fits their definition perfectly. Couldn't fit any institution, organization, or its practicing members more adequately than the AMA's doctrine on quacks and quackery. Now, it is true that the doctors are all licensed, bonded, and insured. They're all licensed professionals. But is allopathic medicine really the correct modality for healing disease? And the answer is no, it isn't, and the AMA specifically says so in their own constitution. And they specifically avoid cure. The AMA and the medical profession is not there to cure your diabetes or cure your cancer. They specifically say we're here to treat it, not to cure it. A couple of good reasons for that is that cures don't make any money. Treatments do. And there's a story in the Bible about a woman, and she had an issue of blood. Today we'd call that leukemia. And this lady had been to the physicians, and she had consumed all of her money. She spent it all on the doctors. And now that her insurance had run out, in modern times we say, well, our insurance has expired and we don't have insurance, and we've done everything that the medical doctors have told us to do. And they just sent her home to die because there wasn't any more they could do. And she'd heard about a fellow named Jesus and how he had healed people. And so one day there was a crowd of people around Jesus, and so she got up as close as she could to him in the crowd, and then she touched the hem of his garment. Now, on the hem of his garment, there were tassels. Jesus was a practitioner of the law, and so he had a fringe on his garment. Well, anyway, when this lady touched that fringe on his garment, she was immediately healed. And Jesus said to the crowd around him, he said, "Who touched me?" And his disciples, you know, three or four of them, said, "My God, here you are being thronged by a bunch of autograph seekers, and you're asking who touched you?" You know, kind of like Michael Jackson, you know, being thronged by people, and they're all touching him, and they're jostling him around here, sign my autograph book. And he turns around and says, "Oh my God, who touched me?" Kind of an odd thing to say. And he had felt the power, the virtue is the King James translation. He felt the power go out of his body to somebody. It's called energy. And he looked at the woman, and she said, "Well, I'm the one that touched you, and I'm sorry I did that, and I didn't mean to cause any harm, but see, I've been sick for a long time." And he said to her, he said, "Now your faith has healed you. Go your way in peace." Now, doctors and clergymen today subscribe to allopathic medicine. So when your preacher goes up to the hospital to pray for you or your child or somebody, he subscribes to allopathic medicine. He doesn't subscribe to the biblical modality of healing. I thought I'd bring that to your attention. In Exodus 15, verse 26, God, the creator of the universe, has a modality that he recommends for healing people, you know, when you get sick. Let me read it to you. We don't do this in our hospitals, and certainly the AMA isn't into this. This isn't scientific. I'm not claiming science. I want to pass on a message to you. This is the message that comes from the God of creation. This is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He said, "If you will diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord your God, and will do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear to his commandments, and keep all of his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Eternal that healeth thee." So God identifies himself as your healer. Now, I know that you're not interested in that, and I don't want to offend you in any way. I just want to deliver the message. Now I've delivered the message. And your Creator says he's your healer. And he says, "If you will diligently hearken to me and practice all of my commandments and statutes, I won't lay any of these diseases upon you." So these diseases come from the Creator. And he's the one that says, "I'm laying these diseases upon you." These diseases, like cancer and diabetes, these degenerative diseases now, are the natural results that occur when you violate these 19 health laws. I've mentioned these a time or two. Let me do it again. In the Bible, there's 19 health laws. And God says, now, if you'll practice these laws, first olive out of the jar is prevention. Now, in the last 20 years, the incidence of diabetes here in the United States has doubled. Coincidentally, here in the United States, the consumption of soda pop has doubled over the past 20 years. So at the same time that soda pop consumption has doubled, the incidence of diabetes has doubled. And the average American today consumes 22 teaspoons of sugar per day. 22 teaspoons. Now, one Coca-Cola, one Pepsi, one Mountain Dew contains 9 teaspoons of sugar. 9. So we start off with 22. That's the average consumption. One Coke equals 9. And your body can digest 3. I'm going to write down digest 3. Okay. So the average American is consuming 3 times as much sugar as his body can digest. If he just drinks one soda pop a day, this isn't a zero out Coke now. It doesn't make any difference what soda pop brand you drink, just a Coke a day. Just one contains, that's a 12-ounce Coke, contains 9 teaspoons. And your body can digest three, and that's three times more than your body can digest. What do you think is going to happen to your body organs when you overtax them with a substance like sugar in an excess that your body can digest? Do you think something might happen? Could there be a consequence to that? Well, hell, if 22 teaspoons is good, wouldn't 44 teaspoons be twice as gooder? Wouldn't that be better? If 22 is acceptable, 9 is good, why don't we double it? Well, over the past 20 years, we did. We doubled it, and the incidence of diabetes doubled. I'd like to make a prediction. If over the next 20 years, we can persuade Americans to consume twice as much soda pop as they're consuming today, I predict that we can double the incidence of diabetes again. That would be my conclusion. Just as a dumb farmer, I just thought I'd tell you. Now, I've never heard the AMA come out and say, stop drinking Coca-Cola. I'm not here to tell you to stop drinking Coca-Cola. I'm not on any kind of a kick. I'm not here to save you. I'm not here to persuade you. I'm a reporter, remember? I'm here to tell you this is the way it is. Now, you are a voter. You are a sovereign citizen. You are an adult. You have free moral agency. You can choose what the hell you want to eat, what you want to do, and how you want to do it. I know you may be subjected to coercion from time to time by your government, but you know the ultimate choice, boys and girls, is you make that ultimate choice. Now, there's another section here in the Bible, and I'm not a preacher now, so I'm not here to preach at you, but I wanted to tell you about another little section that's in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel was a prophet, and God gave Ezekiel an instruction. And this is an instruction that I thought would apply to all you preachers out there. You know, all you guys that are men and women of the cloth. They say you're a man of the cloth. I don't know what the hell that means, but that's what they call them. Well, here's God's instruction to you men of the cloth. He said, Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore hear the word at my mouth and give them instruction or warning from me. When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest them not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way, to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity. But his blood will I require at your hand. Yet, if you warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity. But you have delivered your soul. Again, when a righteous man does turn from his righteousness and commits iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die, because you have not given him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteousness, which he has done, shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at your hand. Nevertheless, if you warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned. Also, you have delivered your soul. Now that's a little story, a little citation from Ezekiel 3, verses 17 through 21. That's for you men of the cloth. When was the last time you ever heard a preacher stand up in church and say, you should stay away from Coca-Cola, Big Macs, and French fries? Did you ever hear a preacher stand up and say, you should stay away from the flu vaccine, these 35 vaccinations, and you should obey God, keep his commandments, and practice the 19 health laws? Have you ever heard a preacher do that? Because boys and girls, as old as I am, I haven't heard that. Now, it is true that there are some preachers out there that do warn their fellow men of the penalties that accrue from the violation of laws. There are some out there, but I haven't heard them, and I'm not hearing them today. Now, as a reporter, it's been my observation that there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. As a law school instructor, I have to tell you that if you could have a law without a penalty, you wouldn't have a law, because the very definition of a law says that there has to be a penalty for the violation of the law. Otherwise, you don't have a law, you have a suggestion. So when you violate a law, there has to be a penalty. Has it ever occurred to us that diabetes is a penalty, that cancer is a penalty, scurvy is a penalty? Something is being laid upon us. So here's God comes along and says, hey, listen, I'm going to lay these diseases upon you. And there's 450 of these diseases, 450 penalties that come from the violation of these 19 health laws. Now, let me add one more little piece to the puzzle here. You can't get sick without violating one or more of these 19 health laws. So they're all contained in the scripture. They're all code plaid out. And in my book on the Mosaic Law, oftentimes, you know, somebody will write me a letter and they'll say, here, you're talking about these 19 health laws. You send me a stamp, self-addressed envelope, and I'll send you the list. It doesn't cost you anything. Well, it costs you the price of a postage stamp and a couple of minutes of your time. But here again, I'm not trying to get you to get off on some kick. I'm here as a reporter to tell you, to give you the information. Now, the AMA, have you heard the AMA? Have you heard any medical doctor or any man of the cloth give you instruction on health? The AMA says, hey, that's not our thing. We're not here to cure disease. Hey, the AMA, who sells food recommendations, you know, for green consideration, they take bribes in the form of advertisement in the same way that politicians take bribes in the form of campaign contributions. I mean, we cover up the bribery, and we hang nicely. We put a spin on it, at least here in the United States we do. So we don't call, you know, politicians bribe takers. We call those campaign contributions. So when this politician is receiving campaign contributions from the pharmaceutical industry, when there's votes to be taken in the Congress or in your legislature concerning this thing of legislation that impacts upon the AMA or upon health care or upon, how in the hell do you think that politician's going to vote, huh? Do you think it's time that we all woke up and smelled the coffee here? Now, in Massachusetts, let me give you an illustration. The other day in Massachusetts, they passed a law. Just saw it in the International Forecaster for Saturday. See, Saturday, the 29th of August, page 8. The Massachusetts legislature has enacted a law to fine you $1,000 a day and 30 days in jail for every day that you disobey a health official. They have now conferred police power upon health officials. Who is a health official in Massachusetts? I don't know. But I would presume that your doctor is a health official. He's licensed by the state. Now, you've got a social lady out there. You've got a school nurse. I would presume that the school nurse is a health official. Social lady requires that your children be inoculated to send them to school. I presume she's a health official. Then you've got a board there, and I think that board, you know, designates nurses. I think nurses are health officials. Teachers. Teachers are stool pigeons working for government institutions called schools. I think they're health officials. Now, let's just put this together. Let's suppose that your kid is sent to school, doesn't have his vaccinations, and the school nurse says, hey, you get your vaccinations. Hell, they'll fine you $1,000 a day and send you to jail for 30 days for every day that you disobey the health official. Is there a way around it? Yeah, there is. The First Amendment protects you, but do you know how to use the First Amendment? You know, most people don't. Now, Massachusetts now is the first state that I know of that's come up with a law like this. I mean, we've got compulsory vaccination, but I've never heard of fining you $1,000 a day and sending you to jail for 30 days for each day of the violation. Now, that's getting pretty draconian. Now, just picture this. Let's suppose that they come to you, you know, next month, and they say, hey, swine flu vaccine time. Roll up your sleeve, and you say, hell no, I won't go. Are you prepared to defend that? I am. I can. I'm not complaining about it, and I would imagine that most of the people of Massachusetts need their flu shots. Most of them are medical illiterates to start with, medically incompetent, unable to take care of their own bodies, and need a guardian to tell them when to get up in the morning, when to go to bed at night, and what to do in between. I don't deny that. Most people are medically incompetent in the same way that they're legally incompetent. That's why they need a lawyer. They're financially incompetent, and that's why they need a bank and a banker to take care of their money. All of the professions are, in fact, guardian ward relationships in which people who sign up for these services declare themselves to be incompetent and unable to manage their own affairs in these areas of their lives. So I can understand the state saying, well, you know, people out there are incompetent medically, and so therefore we need to tell you what to do and how to do it. I'm not medically incompetent. I know exactly what to do. Now, the American Medical Association calls people like naturopaths quacks. People like alternative medicine is called quackery. Chiropractors were called quacks. Not anymore. Not anymore. See, chiropractors now, by court order, have been legitimized, licensed, bonded, and insured, and accepted into the medical framework. But it wasn't too many years ago. You know, I can remember chiropractors were called quacks by the AMA until a court order came down. Now the AMA doesn't call them quacks anymore. What happened? Huh? What changed? Have chiropractors done something different than they were doing 50 years ago? Now, the truth of the matter is the people who are licensed to identify quacks are, in fact, the quacks themselves by their own standards and by their own admissions. Jesus said, you'll know them by their fruit. Can you take a look at the fruits of the American Medical Association and then identify them for what they are? I don't need to call them quacks. I'm just raising the issue and let you come to a conclusion. For instance, take a look at spontaneous remission. Remember I reported to you when we were talking about cancer last week, 6% of the cancer cases heal themselves. They just go away. And they call it spontaneous remission. Now the American Medical Association comes along and says, well, wait a minute. You didn't have cancer at all. That's their first line of defense. Well, then you didn't have cancer. Well, excuse me. If you didn't have cancer, then why did you diagnose me with cancer? My wife, Jackie, was diagnosed by the medical profession. Several medical doctors looked at her in 1978 and said, you've got cancer. Now, she did not go through the approved program, cut, burn, and poison. She went the alternative route, and the cancer went away. When she went back, they said, oh, you didn't have cancer at all. One of two things came up here. Number one, the medical profession cannot accurately diagnose cancer. They claim that they can. So 6% of the time, they misdiagnose it. Well, then that ought to send you a signal. The next time the doctor says, you've got cancer, don't you think you ought to ask the question, well, now, doc, how do you know I've got cancer? Maybe I've got spontaneous remission. Because that's what you're going to say if I go out here and I use one of these alternative methods to deal with my cancer and rely upon my immune system. You're going to say, my spontaneous remission doesn't exist. Because if it exists, then shouldn't they be investigating spontaneous remission, which does in fact occur 6% of the time, and find out why that works so that we can apply it to the 63% of people that cut, burn, and poison doesn't work for. I know it's a wild new concept, but mull it over until next time when we come back with more on this thing of quack and quackery from the AMA. Meanwhile, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by pre-arrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.